Hello, everyone, and welcome back to season 3. We know it is going to be fabulous these next few months here in this bubbling cauldron. It's brimming, I tell ye, brimming. In this episode, we have with us Dr. Florence Sanderson, an obstetrician who has been working in the NHS maternity services for more than 25 years. Florence has a special interest in improving women's experience of maternity care and has been a consultant in London since 2007, where she is currently the lead obstetrician for perinatal mental health, as well as working with the birth options team and home birth team. As a member of the London Maternity Clinical Network, Florence was responsible for the innovative Maternity Whose Shoes co-production workshops piloted across London in 2014. As a result, she co-founded #MatX with Jill Phillips, a grassroots movement of women, families and staff caring for them and working together to improve maternity services, and is also a clinical representative on the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynaecology Women's Network. Florence hosts the podcast The Obs Pod, where she works towards demystifying obstetrics and helps both maternity staff and families. Today, we talk about how midwives and obstetricians can work more collaboratively in the hospital system. We discuss safety, the current discussions on physiological birth as radical thinking, and the thoughts of some who propose inductions for everyone. Florin talks us through her lithotomy challenge and the simple power of nurturing touch. She clearly points out how this education tool can spark our knowledge of how disempowering this can be to a woman. And we discuss how the small changes, or what is often known as the warm and fluffies, for both obstetrician and midwife can make a significant difference for the woman physiologically as well as emotionally. And Florence leaves us with her zesty nuggets, shall we say, for all of us to work in a space that benefits and protects women, midwives and obstetricians. So welcome to this episode of The Midwives Cauldron. I'm Katie James and this is The Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host.
Oh, but look, I'm messing about with volume now. Is that better?
You're getting a bit technical there, Rach.
Is that better?
No, it's just
insane. Oh, that's because that's the input. Hang on. Is that better?
Yeah.
Is it? No, is it really better? Or are you lying to me to make me feel better?
Sounds the same to me, but
it does.
You know,
I'm just trying to convince myself. It's fine. Right, okay. I can deal with the levels. I can bring you up. I always have to bring you up because my mic is, and also I'm loudmouth. So there we go.
Is the output the thing that goes out, or is which bit which is?
I don't know. I don't know. Sorry, I don't know. Not that clever.
I always get them confused. All right. Input. We'll just have to deal with this.
It's grand.
See, we just spent, can hear we you. Always have the arguing like old ladies for the first 10 minutes.
Is it? I feel like it helps our guests feel at home with us.
Yeah.
And know what you're going to get yourself into.
Well, I'm feeling like it's weird because I'm in the middle of a podcast that I listen to. So it's like, oh, I feel like I sort of know you from listening to you, but of course I don't at all.
And now you do.
And I was just listening to you this morning. Florence, I was listening to the GDM one.
Oh,
me last
your
night.
Your GDM Pac-Man thing is just so brilliant. I love that.
So good.
Well,
isn't
I sent my students. I sent my students today to go and listen to yours.
Oh, thank you very much.
And I just sent someone else to go and listen to your big babies.
Oh,
so there you go.
Yeah,
we were both doing
babies.
The same thing.
Oh, yeah. God, big babies.
Good morning, Florence. And thank you so much for joining us. We are really thrilled to have you with us, Florence from the Obs Pod. And joining us in the cauldron with the midwives is just a thrill. We've been waiting several months to bring this together. And today is the day, which is fantastic. And so welcome. And what I'd love you to do for our audience is if you could introduce yourself a little bit from your perspective of, you know, where you come from, how you started your podcast, and we've got a few questions for you as well.
Okay, lovely. Well, I'm massively excited to be here. I love your podcast. Sorry, my mic just fell over.
That's perfect. That goes well with the cauldron theme.
I'm very excited to be here. One of my listeners actually recommended your book, Rachel, which is how I kind of found you. I am an NHS obstetrician. I've been practicing O&G since 1994, so that's like 27 years. And I'm slightly unusual in that I'm just an obstetrician. I'm not an obstetrician and gynecologist. I gave up gynecology partly because I wanted to work part time and have my own children and, you know, life. And partly because really obstetrics, maternity care has always been my passion. And about maybe, I mean, people have always kind of talked to me a bit about, oh, you know, you're an honorary midwife, really, Florence. So I've always been quite woman-centered, shall we say. And about 5 or 6 years ago, I started to do some work for the London Clinical Network, looking at women's experience of maternity care. And at the time, I was kind of told, well, that's the fluffy stuff. That doesn't really matter. You know, Florence, we're doing the serious stuff. We're doing the safety and evidence and all that stuff. And, you know, you're dealing with a bit of fluff and nonsense. Mm-hmm. But the more I did, the more I realized actually it's not fluff and nonsense, which I mean, obviously I always knew that, but you know, the connection between how a woman's communicated with and her experience of maternity care is integral to the safety element. So it's not safety or experience, it's both things. So I've been running quite a lot of maternity experience workshops with a colleague, Jill Phillips, who has a Who's Shoes board game, which is quite exciting, interactive way of exploring experiences with all members of the team and the women we care for. Mm-hmm. And then I was at an event at the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and they had a speaker, a woman speak about her podcast, Fertility Poddy. And she said, oh, it's really easy to start a podcast. And a podcast is a great way of reaching a new audience and people that might not otherwise read stuff or look at stuff on, I tweet quite a lot, look at stuff on Twitter. And she just inspired me because I've always been someone that loved talking. So I thought, oh my God.
Person of my own heart.
This could be my thing. I could just talk and people could listen. And I just thought I'd experiment. Because I think that's one of the things that doing this work has allowed me to do is be creative. So not be just a doctor, but actually explore my creative side, writing and talking and presenting and whatever. So I thought, oh, I'll give it a go. So I listened to, obviously, a podcast on how to make a podcast.
Of course.
And then followed the checklist that they had on how to make a podcast and started. And then I haven't really looked back. I love it. I enjoy it so much. It gives me something a bit different to do. I can explore different topics. And from the very start, I always wanted it to be that midwives, obstetricians, medical students, people could listen to it who are professionals. But I wanted it also to be intelligible to women using a maternity service. And so I always tried to do it that it could be any old person listening and try and have a little take-home message, which is my zesty bit, which is kind of you talk about nuggets. What's the little nugget? What's my zesty bit that I want people to try and remember and take away into their, there goes the microphone again, into their
that's
life.
That's staying in, you know it is.
So Sorry, I'm rambling now.
No, that's great. It's good.
We'll have to have zesty nuggets. I think there's a
zesty nuggets.
Nuggets.
But then the nuggets are poop, and the zestiness really not working with me. But they, I know it's
not
nuggets
all the
of
nuggets
gold.
Are poops. There's some gold nuggets and there's some poop nuggets.
Yeah.
Let's just make it clear which ones are zesty, okay? Yeah. Because otherwise that's got all types of connotations.
Yeah. So it's, And it's going okay, but the thing I really love is when either occasionally a woman messages me or walks into my clinic and says, oh, I've listened to your episode, like you mentioned Big Baby. I've had a woman come into clinic and say, I need to talk about my scan, blah, 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 blah. And then some of the midwives where I work listen to my podcast. And a woman said the other day, I've listened to your Big Baby episode. And I was kind of like, fantastic. Now we can start the conversation in the right place rather than me having to go through this and that and you know, half my job's already done because she understands what I'm talking about. So that's brilliant. And I've had some student midwives also contact me and say how helpful they're finding it. So that's what I do it for, really. But I do it because I enjoy it.
That's fabulous. I want to ask a question because I want the audience to know how you found us or how you found Rachel.
Yes.
Because it was really interesting for me as the outsider almost here. And then to hear that your podcast on that brought me to tears. I had to stop it at points to listen. Mm. So I'm going to let you tell that story just because I think it's really nice. So the audience know how we've got together.
So I was celebrating a year of doing my podcast. And so I put out a tweet to my audience saying, what would they like me to talk about? What topics would they like me to cover? And a lady called Margaret tweeted me saying, I'd like to know what you think about birth as a rite of passage. And I thought, I've no idea what she's talking about. So I Googled and up popped Rachel's book. So I thought, okay, better buy that and read that. And it was quite a read, I have to say. It was very interesting, but it was quite a read because it made me think, oh my God, what am I doing? Like so much of what I'm doing day in, day out is just awful. And obviously, I don't get to see very much of the totally spontaneous, amazing birth because those women and those midwives don't need me. You know, they're either at home or they're on the birth center. So a lot of what I see is induction or an epidural or very sort of telling women to do things. And I think the thing that really got me in the book was the idea of grooming compliance that really made me feel very uncomfortable, even though I could see exactly what you meant. And I don't disagree. So it made me think about how do you get the balance right between some intervention, which obviously is necessary, and where you're starting to intervene perhaps without good evidence, but you hold the power and therefore you're grooming that compliance. So it really made me think about my practice. And I ended up at the end of the book thinking, oh, I don't know how I can go to work now. So I can't remember quite what happened next, but I think I might have Googled you, Rachel, and found your website and then realized you had a podcast. So I then immediately listened to The Midwife's Cauldron, How to Work in the System. And I found that incredibly helpful because I think I can end up feeling responsible for everybody and everything. And that helped me kind of get back to, okay, within this system, I can't possibly change the entire system. But in my small way, I can do little things and I can think about things and I can talk to people at work and I can lend them your book, which I have. And I can kind of narrow it down to what I can do. So I found that episode, or episodes, wasn't it? I think it was two on how to work in the system. Really, really helpful. And I imagine for a lot of midwives or student midwives, having that episode to kind of give you a bit of grounding so that you don't feel like you're flailing around hopelessly in this situation that you can't control, was really, really good. And then I just got listening from there. And some of your analogies and discussions, I just think, you know, they're brilliant. And I think it's quite good because it's in the book. I was disappointed that you didn't talk more about obstetricians. And I did contact you, Rachel, and go, what about your obstetricians? Surely there must be some obstetricians. And I think you came back going, yeah, it's a bit different in Australia. But I think for me, the multidisciplinary team is very, very strong, and the midwifery obstetrician working relationship with the woman at the center is really important. And that was the bit that I thought, oh, that didn't kind of come through to me in the book. And therefore I kind of was thinking, oh, where's my place in all this? I can't just be the bad guy.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour. Your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together.
Yeah, and I purposely wrote, I wrote the book for midwives, midwifery students, birth workers, women. And, you know, I've had a couple of people say, well, you didn't address obstetricians, so why didn't you write this for obstetricians, or obstetricians need to read this book? And my whole, I mean, you know, I kind of say, look, that's not, from my perspective, most obstetricians, and you are an outlier, would not be interested. And I'm not in the business of trying to convert people or, you know, proselytize and change people's minds. I am there for those who are open to listening to me. And actually, you know, that's mostly midwives, midwifery students. And I also think we're having, and, you know, obstetricians are getting caught up to some extent in the what I see as a midwifery identity crisis that I talk about and I write about a little bit, where roles are getting blurred and midwives aren't sure who they are because, as you say, they're not seeing physiology, which is actually the realm of the midwife, is that promoting and supporting physiology and then working with obstetricians to support women who step outside of that. But midwives aren't seeing that. So they're getting very blurry around who does what and whose job it is to do what. And I completely agree in terms of the collaboration, which is what I put into the medical birth chapter. And, you know, I don't know whether our listeners are aware of the huge differences. I mean, Katie, you'll probably have something to say on this too, from UK obstetrics from when I was there versus Australia. It is like, so I had gone from in the UK working collaboratively with obstetricians where, you know, you would come together around the care of a woman and you would be respected as the midwife and you would respect the obstetrician's input and the woman would be involved in the discussions as well. And I came over to Australia and it was a huge culture shock because we had obstetricians who were just treating midwives as handmaidens, no respect at all. You weren't even included in the discussions around what was going to happen. You were told what was going to happen. Yeah. And it was operating more like, I guess, more like nursing, like hospital-based nursing, because that's what it grew out of. And the and then when I looked at the history in Australia, I could understand where it was coming from. So I had a huge culture shock in terms of the relationships and the collaborative way of working. Even in the public system, the private system was hilarious because I completely didn't understand that and stepped on obstetricians' toes by not understanding. But it was, there was one situation, for example, where a woman was hemorrhaging, and it was one of those hemorrhages where you just do a trickle, not like a gush, but like one where you just go, I would like to actually give some medication for this. So this is in a private hospital setting, and I went out and said, where do you keep the ergometrin and the blah, 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 and the PPH box? And I was told, don't do anything until you've rang the doctor.
Oh, the doctor's
not even in the hospital. And I'm like, well, I'll do this and then I'll let them know. No, yeah. You need to. So I'm on the phone to a doctor while a woman's trickling. And then the doctor said I wasn't allowed to actually give her the medication until they'd reviewed.
Oh, and wow.
Jesus. And that's, so it's a very different.
Gosh.
Very different relationship.
Oh my God, I never worked in the private system in Australia, which I'm glad for, but
that sounds quite scary actually.
It is
It is a huge difference. Like, I had a culture shock as well, came over, and I was actually like, I felt like I'd lost my career. I really felt like I was devastated. It took a couple of years to really, like, I'd have those moments of, actually, I remember the Call the Midwife series had started. So whenever that was, I think I moved over in about 2007, and I couldn't watch it because I would get through most of the first episode and I'd be sobbing, saying, I'm no longer a midwife, because my training had been, in a way, I mean, me and Rachel trained together. It was very much community based. I'd then moved to London, gone to quite a small hospital in London. We did a fair amount of home births. I mean, it's not huge, but we also had this beautiful collaboration, like just even, you know, nights out with the students, the midwives and the doctors. Like, we would have a tea room together and we would actually talk and discuss. There would be this kind of respect for the, you know, the midwife who's been there 20 years and the junior doctors coming on. And then it would be this kind of, are you happy, Katie, to take the junior doctor with you today? And you would talk through what's going on. And then it was this collaboration with the woman in terms of, you know, maybe she'll be happy for you to do a vaginal examination, but if we need to do one. And but it wasn't like, it was, I don't know, it was just working as a team. It was lovely. And I'd had 6 years of that and then 3 years as a student as well. I go to Australia, I can't watch Call the Midwife until I try three times over 3 years. Because I would just break down in tears, having felt that my entire career as a midwife was over because I was now in a hospital. I was working as a lactation consultant at that point, but still felt the massive disparities, the disconnection with what I'd lost in a way. And then also being faced with other midwives coming from parts of the UK or New Zealand, and them also sort of like admitting it in corners, going, this is how I feel. And it's shocking. And then the more you read, the more you learn, you see these differences in this. It's hard. It's a real, it feels like you've been swept up and, but it's tough luck. You've chosen to live in this, you know, this wonderful place in Australia and everyone's happy and there's sunshine and blah, blah, blah. But inside you're dying because you become a midwife or you become a healthcare professional usually because there's this passion that you want to help women like you, Florence.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the essence. That's the core. And when it's taken away.
Somebody did some research on that. Actually, I'll have to look it up and see if we're going to link it. Somebody actually did research on UK midwives coming to Australia. And what are you pointing at?
I'm cutting this. What? Because I was interviewed for that. It's Mary Sidebotham.
You can still include it.
I couldn't get through the interview without crying.
I was interviewed for that as well.
Oh, there you go.
That's really sad.
So I didn't know you were interviewed for it.
And the overall findings of the research that Kate's going to cut was it was about...
No, I can't.
It was the...
I have to admit that we were both... Okay, we were both in the research then.
The findings were all about the grief. It was, if I remember rightly, it was some years ago now. It was about grief and the grief cycle and how midwives went through the...
Wow.
All of that grief. So, yes, so I apologise, Florence, if I was mean about obstetrics.
No, no, you don't need to apologise. It was a very thought-provoking book. It just made me think, what am I doing? What am I doing with my life? Because when I contacted you, you told me the context in Australia and that then made sense. Maybe you need to write another book for obstetricians.
Maybe you could do that and I'll help.
Yeah, maybe.
That sounds great. That is a good project.
Yeah, because I think, so yes, I agree I'm an outlier. I am conscious I'm an outlier. Mm-hmm. I'm an outlier even in my own unit. But I do know quite a lot of, I don't know if it's a generational thing, but I do know quite a lot of like-minded UK obstetricians. I guess I'm gradually getting a network of people that, yeah, they're up for this sort of thing and they do care and they, not that other people don't care, but these things are important to them. So maybe the moment is now, maybe something's shifting. I don't know. I don't know. Also in the UK, we've got far more women entering O&G now. So the proportion, in fact, having a male trainee is relatively rare, which is leading to all sorts of workforce problems because obviously women go off and have babies and work part-time and, you know, do all these things that don't fit in.
God forbid we do things such as that.
I know. Wrecking
the system.
That was very eye-opening when I had my own babies and I thought I was working in a maternity unit, but they were really horrible to me about being pregnant. That was a whole nother thing.
Wow.
But because we've got a much more female workforce, I don't know if that's having an impact or whether it's just more modern era, less paternalistic behaviour. I don't know.
So you've seen a change over time?
Positive. I think so, yeah. And there's definitely... I can definitely think of not masses, but definitely a good number of obstetricians in the UK. There's a new society called BICS, British Intrapartum Care Society, that was founded a couple of years ago. And that was just basically a group of us got together and we were informally networking. And then we thought, we really ought to be a college affiliated specialist society because everything else has a specialist society. So there's one for colposcopy and there's one for urogynecology and there's one for minimally invasive surgery. Why isn't there one for intrapartum care? Well, no, the labor ward is kind of core to everything we do. Why doesn't that count as a specialist interest? And not me, but some people I know set it up 3 years ago, and we've had two conferences, and I actually opened the first conference by speaking about personalized care, and I brought with me a woman I'd looked after and her baby so that I could tell her story and she could tell her side of the story on stage at the beginning of the conference. So there's definitely a new generation of obstetricians in the UK that are in that kind of mindset, but it's early days. So now we just need to infect the rest of the world by the sound of things.
You do. You're doing a good job of starting it to get it out there.
In the UK, my experience of obstetricians, I obviously maybe had a good batch, but I'm trying to think, there wasn't any particularly, you know, obviously junior doctors circulating, you see all kinds of different practices. But perhaps it was helped because the lead consultant's wife had home births. So it was very much kind of, we were talking a while back now, but the obstetricians I worked with face to face, I never had any problems with. I mean, there was one, and I don't know how you think about this, but in terms of communication, you know, some people complain about obstetricians and their communication strategies, etc. But one of the best obstetricians I ever worked with had the worst communication ever in the birth room. You know, you often had to do damage limitation after he left, but he was the most skilled and awesome practitioner. I saw him get a baby out with forceps so gently and, you know, efficiently and effectively that I would far rather have called him into an emergency and dealt with the communication issues, because I kind of see that as more my job. Than maybe an obstetrician who could communicate amazingly but was, you know, not skilled.
No, and that's a good point, because the we talk about it as someone having good hands, you know, and when we talk about our trainees, we're like, oh, you know, so-and-so's got, they've got good hands, they're going to be a good surgeon or good practitioner in terms of assisted vaginal birth. And I think you're right, that is very important, because some of the complications that arise are definitely technique or skill. You know, not all of them, but sometimes.
But then that's why the collaboration between midwife and obstetrician, or the relationship between midwife and obstetrician, needs to be so good, because it needs to be a trust within us that even if, say, like you had that example, it's not perfect, that there's no good bedside manner, or you're doing damage limitation with the, with how they speak. But at least if the midwife has this strong relationship with the woman, she has a strong relationship with the obstetrician. There's this, both skill sets that are really, really important are working together at their best.
Yeah. And I think that's really important, because sometimes, for example, if we go to theatre for either an instrumental or a cesarean, and then the midwife, sometimes they're going off, they're getting the resuscitator ready, they're writing their notes, they're doing stuff, and I'll be going, you know, come and talk to the woman, because actually the woman's just moved to a totally alien environment. A whole load more people have just come in, and that midwife, that's going to ground that woman, that it's okay, the person she was with and who knows her and who's been looking after her is still that key person there, coordinating everything and being there for her. And I think a lot of midwives realize that, but I think some of the more junior midwives kind of, maybe they feel, we go to theater and I've stepped back a little bit because now there's all these other people involved and they've taken charge, but actually they need to come in even closer and be with that woman and her birth partner and be that little unit then with all the other people as another layer behind them, maybe.
God, absolutely. I think that's incredibly true. And it's a really difficult thing, isn't it, for maybe new midwives to learn, because it you know, we are becoming more medicalized, depending on what country you're in, obviously. But that's a bit like what you were saying at the beginning. This is the warm and fuzzies. It may not be given the respect it needs, but the midwife who's built that relationship and is with that woman to stay with her when she's had to go into this incredibly scary environment, to be allowed, so to speak, to stay with the woman, and that is her main job as the midwife, is vitally important, worth its weight in gold. There are other people who can bring in a resuscitator and check it. Mm-mm. There are other people who can set up and get that ready. But that person has to stay with that mother and her partner to keep them, you know, feeling as calm as possible and as aware and as informed as they need to be or want to be.
But and, I think that's partly how we train students, to be honest. You know, they focus very much on their assessments as how they're practicing is around skills and doing things, and which is, you know, wrong. I can remember getting some feedback on one of this years ago, one of the students that was in my course from the clinical area, and they were really concerned about this student. And I was kind of saying, well, what were you concerned about? And they said, well, you know, there was a forceps birth that was happening with this woman that this student was following through. And, you know, the student didn't do what she needed to do. And I said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, she was supporting the woman and the partner, and she didn't open the gloves for the obstetrician, and she didn't set up the resuscitator, and she didn't, you know, all these things. And I had to say, well, that's great, because that's actually what I would want her to be doing. But from their perspective, this, you know, she didn't know the things to do. And you're right, Florence, you know, missing the point that the thing to do is to ground the woman and to be there for her during that. That's actually your job.
Yeah, I think you're right. The curriculum is a problem, because it's the same for trainee obstetricians. It's very task focused. So can I do a cesarean? Have I been signed off as being competent? Can I manage the labour ward board? And prioritize things. You know, it's very task. There's a bit of communication skills and feedback. So they do get feedback several times a year. They have to send out a form for midwives and nurses and consultants and everyone to kind of fill up about how their communication is.
Really?
Yeah, they do.
Throughout the UK now?
Yeah, it's they're called a TO1. So they have to send out, I think they have to get 20. I think it's 10 twice a year or something like that.
Wow.
At least 10 opinions. And they talk about all sorts of things like timekeeping, communication with patients, communication with colleagues, record keeping, it's that sort of thing. So that is really good.
And who fills that out? Is that the midwives and the colleagues that they work
with?
They
have to select who they send it to, but they have to do a mixture of the multidisciplinary team. So we'd usually suggest that they send some to maybe the midwife in charge of the labour ward or the antenatal clinic midwives, or you know, people that have actually seen them in the clinical setting, as well as they have to get a certain number of consultants.
And is that midwives who have to do that as well? Was it just an obstetrician? No,
this is trainee obstetricians and gynecologists.
Okay.
I don't know about midwives. But there is a bit of emphasis on that. And often, obviously, what's useful rather than the tick box is the free text, because often people will write free text about, you know, this trainee talked really nice to this patient and made a real difference, or, you know, or this was a problem. I mean, usually if it's a problem, you get the chat coming back to you as their supervisor way before the forms go out, and then you sit down and talk to them. But there is that formal side of the assessments. But the rest of it is very task. And I think that's where some of the, I don't know if you listened to or are aware of my lithotomy challenge that I did. In fact, I need to do that again because we're getting some new trainees this week. But just that thing of they all think it's really stupid and what am I doing and I'm nuts. But actually, when you put them in lithotomy, even though they're fully clothed and it's a bit of a giggle, they suddenly think, oh, this isn't great. This teaches me something.
So can I
feel really
just
vulnerable.
Stop you. you take the students and you put them in the position of lithotomy, so putting their legs up in the stirrups during a course. Okay, I just wanted to make the listeners understand.
So it started because, you know, there was that thing about the ice bucket challenge where people were tipping ice over themselves for charity. And I thought, oh, so I have lain on an operating table. I had two emergency cesareans, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I know what that felt like. It felt absolutely horrendous. But I have never been in lithotomy. So it was NHS change day and I decided to do a challenge. And I thought I'd be in lithotomy for an hour because I thought, well, that might be second stage plus a bit of suturing.
God, yes.
So I got our consultant midwife to help me. Sorry, I'm going to have to let the dog out. Wait a sec.
We always have animal themes going on in these.
I know. There's always animals. Someone's always got, it's just me. I don't have an animal. I need to get a mascot animal somehow.
I'll send you Floki because he's not in my best books.
Oh, dear. I don't think he's going to cope too well from the post from Australia with a couple of holes in the box, to be
honest. Sorry about that. She was scratching the door, so then she gets noisy.
Yeah, and then you get a poo-poo in the corner.
So, I got the consultant midwife to help me. I put a CTG belt on so that I was physically tied the way you might be. And I wore a hospital gown, but I did wear some shorts. And I got her to put me in lithotomy for an hour. And it was hilarious, actually, because so many people just came in and kind of looked at me and talked across me and walked out again and left the door open and, you know, all the stuff that we do all the time without thinking. It was really eye-opening. And
wow,
the thing that was amazing was that the chair of our Maternity Voice partnership came in and she was a doula. She's now a midwife, actually. She's done her training, but she's a doula. And she came in and she came straight over to me and she started talking to me and gave me a foot massage. And it was completely unprompted and it was, you know, spontaneous. And it was so lovely. I wasn't in labor. I wasn't pregnant. I know. And but even just that touch, you know, you were talking about not being touched, that touch, and someone was there thinking about how is Florence feeling doing this challenge? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go in and make her feel good. And it was, it was amazing. I have got an episode of my podcast about it. But then following that, I've done some sessessions with our junior doctors doing that. They won't all do it, obviously. But they get very, and I've done it with student midwives as well. Kate, the doula I just mentioned, who's now a midwife, she asked me to do a session with her cohort of students when she was training. And I think, you know, people can feel it's a bit ridiculous and it's a bit exhibitionist. But I think when you're in that position, you suddenly realize just how disempowering it is and just how horrible it is. And an hour is really quite uncomfortable. And I didn't think an hour was that unrealistic, to be quite honest. No. And quite a lot of units up and down the country have copied me and done sessions with their staff and done kind of reflective boards about what the staff thought about it. And when I was talking about like-minded obstetricians, there's a lovely obstetrician in Leeds, Sarah, who did the same. She did the whole challenge herself and wrote a blog about how it made her feel. So it kind of sparked a few things for a few people.
I think that's fantastic. Absolutely. Like when you put yourself in that position, it's the emotional and the physical aspect of it. Totally. and you're not even got that emotional pull of I have a baby on board or who's on the resuscitaire and I want to be holding them or the emotions that are going through.
Yeah, and you're not even naked. I mean, if you're naked, then...
Exactly.
And now when I'm going, maybe I'm going, I need the woman in lithotomy, I'll say to her, don't worry, you know, you're only going to be like this for, you know, exposed like this for a second. I'm going to cover you up with some sterile drapes so that she's then a bit more covered. Yeah. And I will try and keep it to a minimum. I mean, I don't know how it works where you are, but we used to have this terrible thing where the midwives would go, so-and-so needs suturing. Her legs are up ready.
I was taught to do that as a midwife, where I went as in the UK.
Yeah.
And it was like, get her ready so that she's ready for when the obstetrician comes in because you don't want to waste their time. They're busy.
Exactly.
And I would be thinking, yeah, but I want her to be having skin to skin and maybe a breastfeed happens. It could be half an hour before they come in if they're really busy or the obstetrician's in theatre, they'll be out soon. It's like, well, what is soon? And this looks really uncomfortable.
Yeah. So we don't do that anymore. And
that's brilliant.
You know, it sounds petty, but going into the room and meeting the woman, hopefully when she's, you know, enjoying cuddle time with her baby and whatever, and then helping her get in the right position or whatever. Yes, it's not necessarily time efficient, and you know it is difficult when you're going from room to room and you've got a number of things. You know, being an obstetrician is a massive multitasking challenge.
Absolutely.
It, you know, that is the reality. But actually, if you can go in, they've got everything ready, but then you help get her into that position, or they're doing that while you're just putting your gloves and gown on or whatever, then you've met her, you've made eye contact with her, you've said hello, who you are. And, you know, it might only take seconds to get her into that position, but to be up in that position waiting for the doctor to arrive, I mean, that just, awful.
So do midwives not suture?
Yes, they do. Yeah, they do. Yes, absolutely, they do. So usually we're called in if there's maybe if they think it might be a third degree tear or if it's something, sometimes if it's labial or around the clitoris or urethra, or if someone's bleeding, obviously. So yes, most of our routine suturing would be midwifery, absolutely.
Okay. But I think that, again, it's this warm and fluffies. We put it in the camp of this is a nice to do. It's not essential. Yes, it takes 5 minutes longer.
Mm.
But my God, does it save on the potential of that woman having trauma from this event? And it may be that most of her birth, she actually felt quite in control. She was having a positive experience for her. And it's that last moment where she suddenly became disempowered, out of control, and she's in lithotomy waiting and not knowing and fear, not having the bonding she wants with her baby because her mind is distracted thinking, there's people walking in, I'm exposed. She's not closed down like she's meant to have been. Mm. And, you know, in that end part of labor, she's in this enchantment period that Rachel talks about. And then, you know, the baby doesn't have a first breastfeed. The baby's given to someone else in preparation because we need to put your legs in lithotomy. These are things that are also the cascade of kind of events that are happening just from this simple process that can lead to someone feeling like their experience was taken away from them, the positive. And the thing is, then they come and see you, or they have to go and see a counselor, or they have to go and deal with potential trauma or flashbacks or whatever the issue is, because we save 5 minutes of time.
Mm.
Now, how do we get that message out? How do we work more collaboratively and change these types of practice in, yes, it's task orientated. Yes, there is a huge amount for obstetricians to balance and triage. It is not an easy job at all. And also, you know, as a midwife, I always feel sorry in a way, like the obstetricians often see just when it goes wrong. It's a bit like me as a lactation consultant. If I just worked as a lactation consultant and not kind of as a midwife, I get called in just when it's going wrong. And I would have this impression that, Jesus, breastfeeding is all hard work and just awful. And why does anyone do it? And I would be coming from that perspective. So how do we make, because it is those small changes that actually make a bloody massive difference. But when we look at it in the research, it's not considered important enough. It doesn't go in the journals that have these high standings.
But I think one of the approaches is to not address the warm and fluffies, because some people will never be interested in the warm fluffies. But you look at the physical impact and the outcomes. I mean, physically being in lithotomy for a long length of time, women have actual physical damage, particularly when with epidurals who have been in a position for a long period of time. You know, and with the, and you look at breastfeeding outcomes and the skin to skin in terms of calming the baby down.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and I've been, what's the word, lambasted about, you know, certain ways of managing the birth of the placenta, you know, the warm and fluffy way of not doing anything and how dangerous that is, when you can then say, well, actually, this is how it supports physiology and this is how it is actual risk management, and talk about it in terms of risk management, then sometimes you can get people on board who wouldn't listen if you were talking about the woman's experience. But if you talk about, but this is risk management because you're going to reduce the chance of a woman having an injury from being in lithotomy for a long period of time. That's an approach I use. I don't know whether that's a very helpful one, but I just sometimes.
I think you're right. I think I definitely feel the getting people in a different way, sort of drawing them in a different way, is the right approach. But it's, I find the sort of the evidence bit really difficult, because there's a lot of kind of quantitative stuff, but there's less qualitative stuff, or the qualitative stuff is given less credibility maybe. But yeah, it is really difficult. But that, I think that you're right, that is the way to draw people in, is safety. I mean, one of the things that really I'm struggling with at the moment is this whole thing of safety versus intervention versus non-intervention for the sort of safety agenda. There's a big, I mean, obviously safety is important in maternity services all the time, but there's a massive safety agenda in the UK at the moment. There's targets to reduce stillbirth. There's targets to reduce preterm birth. And there's a lot of scrutiny of everything we're doing, but it's all, I feel, moving towards more and more intervention, and not sort of, it's almost like the evidence that if we induce all women at 39 weeks, we'll save however many stillbirths. That counts. But the evidence, like the birthplace study, which says home birth is the safest option for multiparous women, we're just going to disregard that. And we're still going to say that hospital is the safest place. And, you know, and literally you cannot say normal birth in the UK without people leaping on you. And I appreciate normal is not necessarily the best description. Physiological birth would probably be much better. But it's how do we empower women to have a physiological birth for the women for whom that is the safest option, and have that as part of our safety agenda? You know, I'm the link consultant for the home birth team. COVID has been brilliant for our home birth rates. Oh my God, it's been fantastic. The home birth rate has rocketed which is brilliant. But still, when someone wants a home birth, other people are looking at them going, well, that's a bit wacky and unsafe. Whereas actually, it's like, no, they're choosing the safest option for them.
Yep.
So I really struggle to get my head around that. And that's a real problem in the UK at the moment. I mean, even yesterday, I was seeing on Twitter some of the people that are very outspoken about safety for lots of good reasons, picking up on the fact that there was going to be a conference talking, not even saying normal birth, but talking about, can we talk about normal physiological birth? It was a tweet from the Association of Radical Midwives. And what it was saying is physiological birth now considered radical? And I thought that's a really good question. But that tweet had already been picked up by other people who violently disagree and is being retweeted and commented on negatively.
We're in a difficult space.
Yeah, very.
Yeah. I mean, we've been in a difficult space for a long time, but where are we going?
I feel it's getting worse. And I worry when I hear your experiences of other countries, and I feel like, are we going to end up in a US type model? You know, I mean, there's a lot of discussion at the moment about, should we be inducing everybody? If you induce anyone after 39 weeks, that the evidence says that that's okay and it doesn't have any difference on section rates and intervention rates and all the rest of it. And
oh my God. Thinking,
so we don't trust a woman to keep her baby safe in her body and go through the physiological process that her body and the baby were designed for.
Oh my God, it feels like we're just going back to kind of 19th century, where it's patriarchal control of our bodies. And again, you know, like we've talked about in previous podcasts, or Rachel has, of this kind of mechanism of women. And it's like we're on a factory line and we're just going to roll people out. And it's and also it's ignoring so much evidence which shows the detrimental effects of induction of labor. And really, that is a last resort. And I mean, you talk about this a huge amount, Florence. God, goosebumps have just run through me at the thought of inducing everyone. It makes me angry as well, as a woman who feels like, how dare someone make a decision just...
Yeah, regardless. We're not there yet in terms of people are arguing about
it. No, thank God. And I don't think we will.
And I don't think we will, hopefully. But it's, and I don't know if you've seen, there was quite a lot of talk on social media about the draft NICE, National Institute of Clinical Excellence, induction guidance for this reason. And a lot of people going, no. Good God, no, you know? And also bringing induction, post-dates induction forward.
I mean, it's bad enough already in many countries.
Yeah, and inducing women from certain ethnic backgrounds earlier. And it's like, okay, so now you're going to be not only have a 5 times higher risk as a Black woman in Britain, but now we're going to take your choices away as well. You're going to be penalised for the fact that we've got a system which gives you a 5 times higher risk. Like, what?
And add in the risks of induction.
Yeah. So, I mean, thankfully, there were a lot of comments back. So it'll be interesting to see what that guidance comes out like, given the number of comments that were chucked back as part of their draft consultation. But yeah.
Do you think there's increasing consumer pushback? Because, I mean, it might just be the kind of circles that I avoid social media, but the social media that I am on seems that I feel there's an increasing number of women who are, yes, probably well-resourced women, who are just going, I'm disengaging from the system. There's an increase in free birth, Definitely. So even just locally, and in Australia, there certainly is. And I think COVID has increased that even further. Do you think that there's an increase in women reclaiming their rights outside of the system, and will that have an impact then on the system?
Yeah, I think there is. I think it goes two ways, though. So I see women that want a home birth who are outside of guidance, who feel like their best option, for example, having a VBAC at home. If you had a cesarean the first time and you feel that was down to a cascade of intervention and things that probably weren't quite right, and was it absolutely necessary? And then to try at home makes logical sense, doesn't it? Because you know there's going to be less obstetric intervention, and you can calculate what risk you're taking by doing that, and the risks are small. So I see increasing numbers of women that want to do something that we label as outside of guidance to try and protect themselves and protect their birth physiology, I guess. And then the other side I see is I'm going to have an elective section. The maternal request cesarean rate is rising rapidly.
Really?
And I think that's lack of trust in the system. You see headlines about safety. You know, you might end up with an assisted vaginal birth. You might end up with an induction. You might end up with an emergency cesarean. So rather than leave it all to chance, I'm just going to have a planned C-section.
Yep.
Wow.
So two polar extremes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I get women who are booked under the home birth team and come and see me because, I don't know, something flags up that they need a bit of input. And they will literally be, I'm either going to have my home birth, or if I can't have my home birth, I'm going to have a planned cesarean with nothing in between. Yeah. If I can't have my physiological birth at home, go into labor at home and do things this way, I'm going to have a planned cesarean. I do not want to have an induction. I do not want to give birth in the hospital.
And that for me just says, you know, women in terms of how they see the system and what they've read and what they've learnt, is that's our way of having control over our bodies.
Mm. Yeah, totally.
And I can see why that would be. Again, there's two polar extremes, but it's like I've made the decision.
Yeah.
I'm in control. I've seen what's happened, or I've had a previous experience and I've been down this cascade of medical intervention.
Yeah.
And it was traumatizing.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's not, you know, some of them are first time mums, but some of them are women that have had a vaginal birth before. Like you say, maybe they had an induction. And on paper, it would look to us like, yeah, it's pretty bog standard birth, you know, nothing terrible happened. Good outcome, relatively straightforward. And for them, rather than being induced again, no, I'll have a cesarean.
And if the system isn't listening to women and what they're obviously quite clearly saying, then, you know, is it ever going to change?
Yeah. I think it is listening more, and there is more levers that mean hospitals do have to listen to women. So the team, again, team of fantastic women who set up. So when we had the National Maternity Review about five, six years ago, there was within that replacing maternity service liaison committees with what's now called a maternity voice partnership. So that is lay service users and midwives and obstetricians and everyone kind of working together. And again, a great group of women just set up National Maternity Voices. And now they've managed to get involvement of your MVP, so that lay representation, into quite a lot of policy documents and things. So when the CQC come and do the inspection, or CNST are looking at your levels of litigation and your indemnity, it's now listed as part of the things they check, is whether you have an active MVP and how are you interacting with your service users, and are you doing co-production with them, and are you meeting regularly. So I think they've got a toehold, that we're getting more of a footing of that. And I did a lot of work on that in the London region, and I know other areas are kind of also quite active. So the work I did in London was bring all those MVPs across London together to try and give them the tools and allow them to network and share ideas and so on. So I think that is kind of getting a bit more ingrained in what is expected of a maternity service, that they do have to have a functioning group working with their, an active group of service users. So I belong to the one at my unit, and we meet every couple of months, but we've got a very active Facebook and WhatsApp, and it's a group of midwives. I'm a bit unusual being an obstetrician on it, and we've got 20 or 30 women that have had babies with us recently that are kind of active doing stuff.
That's fantastic. It's definitely a way to go, again, with collaboration.
But I mean, what we need is investment. I know it's like a bit moany to come back to money, but actually we're trying to implement continuity of care in the UK, and we're doing it really with not the right amount of staff to do it. And the models we're doing are hybrid models, because actually we don't have the staff to do a full proper continuity model, and we don't have the money to do a full proper continuity model. So although the aspiration to have continuity of care for everyone, and we've got targets for continuity of care now, which is absolutely fantastic, and it's making a difference to the midwives, and it's making a difference to the women, and it makes a difference to us as consultants. I've got the home birth team and Emerald team, which is a continuity team for women who've had a previous cesarean. Unless we're going to be able to staff those properly, it's not going to work, is it?
No. If you're doing everything on a shoelace, a shoestring.
Yeah.
It's a continual problem. It's a huge problem in the UK in terms of the number of midwives and staff shortages throughout the NHS, particularly during COVID. And I was going to say post-COVID, we're not even there yet. But
yeah.
I mean, what do you think are your takeaway points for, it's obviously it's very different in each country, but what are the takeaway points for midwives and, say, women to be able to communicate with their obstetrician if they need to see an obstetrician? And in most countries, if we look at Australia, if we look at the US, Canada, certain European countries, women automatically see obstetricians all the way through. In the UK, that wouldn't happen unless there is an identifiable reason. But how can we improve this collaboration? I mean, you've given some really good pointers here, but I'd like us to sort of bring this in of
the zesty nugget.
Yeah, zesty nuggets, not pooey nuggets, zesty nuggets, Florence.
Yeah.
Your lemon nuggets.
Yeah, I think for women, I think it's about, so I have some women that come in and then they leave and they say, oh, that was so much better than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be a big battle. And I think, like Rachel was saying, actually, obstetricians are human beings and we're okay.
Yes.
So don't feel like if you have to come and see us that it's a disaster. And don't be worried about questioning what we're saying. I think, you know, don't take everything you're told as, you know, rote. Be able to ask questions. If you don't understand or you want clarification why a recommendation is being given to you, then it's okay to ask and explore, and also be allowed time to think about what you want to do. I do think that we are very bad at saying, you know, we've got a 15-minute consultation, come in, do the examination, look at the results, talk to the woman, you can do this, this, or this, what do you want to do?
Yep.
And putting her on the spot.
God, so I think, yes.
So I think as a pregnant woman, then don't be frightened. You can ask questions. You can ask for written information. You can go off and think about it. You can go and talk to your family, your partner, whoever it is you get your advice from, and then let us know. That's okay. Don't feel that you're kind of having to say yes on the spot. And I think for the midwives, what I find really helpful, it doesn't always work because sometimes I forget, but I have quite a good relationship with the midwives I work with, and they'll often email me and say, this woman is coming to see you on this date. Here's the context. Here's the background. This is what we want to know from the consultation. This is what's why she's coming to see you. And this is what she's worried about. So if you're a midwife working in a continuity care team and you know one of your women's coming to a consultation, if you give the obstetrician a bit of background and a bit of a heads up, then we can, like I said earlier, you can start a conversation in a better place, because rather than the woman having to rehash through every single thing, she can come in and I can go, oh, you know, Jen, your midwife sent me an email and she's told me a bit about what's going on, you know, and that then puts them at ease that you know a bit about them. Mm-hmm. And it gives me some context in which to have a consultation, and the woman feels like, oh, someone cares and has let this person know, and they know why I'm here, and I don't have to tell them all about my horrible birth last time or my abnormal blood tests or whatever. Because what I hate as an obstetrician is almost like going into a consultation blind. So you've got a busy clinic. Woman comes in, probably someone's done her blood pressure and dipped her urine. They may or may not have done the palpation for me as well, a midwife. And I've got a set of notes, and I don't want to be looking through the notes because the woman sat in front of me and that's rude. I want to be making eye contact and talking to her. But at the same time, I've got to flick through the notes fast enough to know, what's she doing there?
Yeah.
Why is she here?
Yeah. And then make your decisions.
Yeah. So if someone says, oh, this woman's coming and it's because of this, or even if the midwife working with me in clinic, sometimes she'll go, oh, this is whatever the woman's name is, and she's 36 weeks and she's here because she's got itching and her blood test back as this, that, and the other, then I know what I'm doing without having to spend hours reading notes and not talking to the woman. Because I tend to talk, have my consultation, and then write.
Which is so important.
And the documentation is really important, but I want to know what the woman thinks she's there for and what's bothering her first.
And you want to be able to see her reaction as well. It's so important when any of us
With COVID, some of my colleagues were saying, oh, we could do much more telephone consultations. That'd be really good, because that women don't have to come and see the consultant. It's a big deal for quite a lot of the things. We could just do a phone consultation. And I don't know, maybe it's the women I see, or maybe I'm just old, but I just thought, was like, no, No, not at all. I need to see her body language. Yes. I need to see how she's responding. I need to be able to lay my hands on her, like you're saying. How's this baby feel? Is it engaged? You know, what sort of stature is she? You know, what, the man that's come with her, how big is he? You know, like, you know, there's so many different things, aren't there, that you pick up. And
absolutely. And even with women, a mask on, you're looking way past,
and
then, like,
and also things that you'll get to the end of the consultation and then you might go, have you got any questions or anything else you want to ask? And then it all comes out. Yeah. Then they disclose.
Oh, yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
And you're like, oh my God, I'm running off an hour late.
Thank God we got to that point. And she did feel able to say X, Y, Z, because actually the rest of the thing would have been irrelevant.
Totally. And that doesn't happen online, because how many of us have been to webinars or whatever we've been watching the last 2 years online.
Yeah.
And are you going to be the first person to put in what you think might be the silly question?
No, hell no.
I'm waiting for someone else to do it because I'm not going to be the one to put myself out. Sorry. Yeah. I'm one of those.
So I think the face-to-face, and I feel I'm very lucky that actually all through COVID, you know, we're one of the few specialties in the hospital that have still been face-to-face
all the time.
And thank goodness. And also that's what I enjoy, meeting people. Like, I mean, that's part of the job.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Chatting to people.
Yeah. Being part of their lives.
Yeah. In
a really important part.
Yeah.
Really important time.
Yeah.
I think that's lovely, Florence.
It was great.
It's really lovely. Like, what you've actually done for me is taken me back to the UK, and I had a really positive experience there. I loved the whole multidisciplinary team that I worked with, and really just adored it. I miss it. I learned so much. We all learned from each other. Mm-hmm. That was a thing. And there was just this respect, whether you were a junior, senior, doctor, midwife. And I think, you know, there's a lot to learn still from the practices in the NHS and from other countries. And we need to be keeping up the good fight, doing some of the things that you said with students as well, which I just think are bloody awesome. Thank you so much for sharing them. We will share your links to the podcast, which I highly recommend people listen to. And it's just been fabulous to have you. I really appreciate you taking the time and being with us today. Thank you so much.
Oh, not at all. It's a privilege, honestly. I'm very excited to talk to you properly, both of you.
And I think you're the first obstetrician to enter the cauldron.
Oh, you are, Florence.
How exciting.
Oh my God. I need to find a noise that goes, bah, bah. Although I've done it myself. I don't need to find one.
Oh no. Well, that's even more of a privilege then. But no, I'm very excited. And I think you're doing amazing work. I love your podcast. I've recommended your podcast to a lot of people. I must admit, I've recommended it to more midwives, so I need to get out and recommend it to more obstetricians. And
do it.
And birth as a rite of passage is gradually making its way around my maternity unit. I'm not totally sure who's got it at the moment, because I lent it to one person and then they were going to pass it on to another person. So I probably need to check up where it's got to.
You need one of those little old-fashioned library tokens.
Yeah
Stamp it and it has to be back by this date. I do miss that, I must say.
I as long as it's kind of spreading ideas, that's fine.
It might come back with lots of graffiti in it. I have had previous bits of my work graffitiized
in a good way.
Oh, I was a bit stupid when I was new grad and thought it would be really helpful to put the literature review and a table of a literature review of directed pushing.
Right.
And the research at the time for directed pushing, I thought it'd be really helpful to all my colleagues who proceeded to write nasty things on the
Did you put it on the tea room wall?
Yes.
Oh no. That's sad.
Anyway. Well, hopefully my book will come back intact.
We hope you enjoyed the first episode of Season 3. I want to take the opportunity to say thank you to all of you for your continuous support of us and the podcast. We've had some wonderful input from you guys whilst we've been off having a little break. Your utterly wonderful comments on Apple and other podcast hosts are just so inspiring for us to keep going and also blooming lush to read. So thank you for this. Truly, it helps get the word out. You can find all of our and Florence's links in our show notes, as always. And if you fancy supporting the show further, please head on over to our Patreon page. Thanks for being with us in the cauldron for season 3. Here's to much more fun, information, and of course, golden nuggets galore, just how you like it. And of course, as always, I'll leave you with the bloopers. It's official. Rachel, can I just say your speakers are bloody awful?
What do you mean?
It's like I'm over here, I really can't hear you.
Really? There's something strange going on with my microphone because you are so loud, you're bursting my eardrums and I can't turn you down.
There's something strange in the neighbourhood. Who are you going to call? Not Rachel Reed, because you're not going to be able to hear her.
Someone else told me it's good to record inside your wardrobe.
We've done that.
Have you?
Rachel, yeah. We did many, many places that Rachel had to record at the beginning. And then I also hung a red scarf over this and then stuck my head in it. And it was just getting hotter and hotter. And Rachel's like, you look like you're going inside a vulva.
Oh, nice.
Like in, out. And I was talking to her and then trying to look at the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
Sound quality was amazing, but I was dripping. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and lactation, the fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough at times quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created the Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.